This is a repeat episode of the Climate Action Show.
This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Show. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. Andy and I would like to pay our respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, from whose land we are broadcasting at 3CR, and the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, where we can be heard at Radio Skid Row.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Climate Action Show. We're coming to you from the studios of 3CR Melbourne on the Community Radio Network and podcast, which can be found on the internet at 3cr.org.au. Make sure to share the show if you like what you hear. My name is Carly, and today I'll be sharing the expert panel discussions from the Climate and Health Alliance, CAHA, on climate change and mental health. The event was facilitated by CAHA President Dr. Rebecca Patrick, a senior lecturer in the School of Health and Social Development of Deakin University. As a practicing psychologist, I've noticed anecdotally and with the data the increase of climate change-related mental health distress. I really hope you enjoy and get something out of this.
It's a real pleasure to be here tonight to discuss such an important topic. It's been sort of living in the shadows, I think, for a little while, but people are really starting to sit up and take notice that our social and emotional well-being, mental health, is really being significantly impacted by climate change. So back in 2018, we saw and around that time, we saw some really interesting and really still very important discussion papers. The lead author was Helen Berry, and she really sort of started to think about mental health and climate change, many aspects of it, but particularly pointing out that this is a complex relationship. Mental health is always a complex issue that is underpinned and impacted by many, many factors. But when you add climate change into the mix, it becomes even more impossibly complex network. And she's tried to sort of hypothetically map out what that might look like. And what she's quite successfully done there in a really nice, succinct way is get us to think that climate change is expected to impact mental health. We know that now from the evidence, which I'll show on the next slide, but via a range of direct and indirect pathways, and also some existential kind of threat aspects as well, which will get talked about, no doubt, by other panelists. So some of these direct pathways are the obvious ones, such as a bushfire sweeps through and a population is traumatised, or a cyclone or flood or whatever weather-related event that might be. Seems like a fairly linear process. So this is Helen Berry's attempt to hypothetically kind of map out a system in which the mental health impacts of climate change might kind of operate. And of course, there's many direct and indirect pathways that are taking place there. The key message being this is a very, very complex system. So what do we know? Helen Berry has done a beautiful job of discussion papers, which have been very thought-provoking. And the next step is actually to build some evidence around this through research. So we set out as a starting point in a very new and emerging field, research field, to do a systematic review around looking at the mental health impacts of climate change. And we discovered many things. Firstly, that there's not much research done in the space, but what is clear is that weather-related events or climate change-related events are definitely having an impact on mental health. Some of the environmental exposures that have been shown through research to have an impact on a range of mental health outcomes are temperature or heat, in particular humidity, which we may not think about, drought and rainfall, wildfire, bushfire, we all know about that in Australia, and floods, we also know about that in Australia. In terms of the kinds of mental health outcomes, because there are a wide range of sort of definitions here, symptomology of mental disorder, so not necessarily a mental disorder per se, but symptomology that might indicate that someone is heading that way. Such things as psychological distress measured by a bunch of different tools. Psychiatric hospitalizations have gone up. Mortality among people with mental illness has gone up. And self-harm and suicide has also gone up. So what we know about climate change more broadly, but particularly when we're talking about health impacts, is that it doesn't impact everyone to the same extent. So the literature has identified some vulnerable populations, and for sure this won't be a limited list. The evidence will develop and we will uncover other groups as we go. But those with pre-existing mental illness are particularly impacted. Examples of why that might be is people who are on antipsychotics, for example, have reduced ability to thermoregulate during heat waves. The world's Indigenous populations are experiencing a loss of place through rising sea levels or melting sea ice, and their hunting and land-based activities are also being impacted. That's just a few examples of how they're being impacted. Low and middle income countries are being disproportionately affected, and of particular relevance here in Australia are our neighbouring small island developing states. What comes to mind immediately is inundation, as you can see in the picture there. And another group is young people, and I know that I'm not going to spend much time on that because I know that other panellists are going to do so. So I presented what we do know, but the fact is that there is a lot more that we don't know. So to date, more than 80% of research in this field explores the mental health impacts of climate change. They're trying to work out what is actually and by how much is our mental health being impacted by climate change. But actually, we really have a poor understanding of which factors increase our vulnerability and or our resilience to the mental health impacts of climate change. Very little research related to interventions or policies designed to safeguard us. So importantly, research will assist decision makers to develop robust evidence-based mitigation and adaptation plans. And in summary, tackling climate change could actually be the most significant opportunity to shape our mental health for centuries to come because of the health co-benefits of transitioning to more sustainable ways of living.
So you've given us the science and the best available evidence. We have an understanding now of who our priority groups are, and we also understand to some extent the impacts of climate change, how it's manifesting in the mental health space. But you've also highlighted for us, Fiona, that there's knowledge gaps, particularly around where and we should make our investments for interventions. And I suppose what we're now going to hear from the panel is some of the case studies of clinical and community practice. So some of the anecdotal lived experience as well. So we're going to start with Sibel. You have a particular interest in child and adolescent psychiatry as per the bio we introduced you with. Can you tell us about how you are seeing mental youth health being impacted by climate change?
Climate change is already impacting mental health of children and young people in Australia today. And in terms of the things that I'm seeing as a child and adolescent psychiatrist and through looking at the literature, extreme weather events and hotter weather are examples that are quite clearly having an impact on children and young people here, as well as the impact of children and young people being worried about climate change based on realistic concerns about what's going to happen. So a recent survey showed that more than 50% of children and 16 to 25 year olds, so teenagers and young adults, were extremely or very worried about climate change. And in terms of coming back to those impacts of climate change through other methods, other pathways, if you think about exposure to extreme weather events, a six-year-old today will live through three times as many extreme weather events as their grandparents, and that's recently published data in Science. In terms of what I'm seeing, the other thing that I'm seeing is the increases in presentations, which, as I've put in the chat, had happened before the impacts of the climate pandemic. Sorry, not the climate pandemic, of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thanks, Sabelle. So I heard in that kids, heat, and worry about realistic concerns, and it's real and it's now. Thanks, Sabelle. We'll come back to you shortly. Carol, you have been working with climate activists and others in this space. Can you tell us a bit about how their mental health is impacted by working on climate issues?
Yes, we work with climate activists. We also work with those who are working in the space of climate change as researchers or academics or policymakers or scientists. And we have noticed in our work, we offer supportive workshops to people, which I'll talk about a bit later, but we have noticed that they're feeling an intense weight of the work they're doing, and that's increasing, of course, and especially with the build-up to the Glasgow conference. Much of the feeling that they carry is an aspect of grief, deep sadness, anger at the lack of action, despair that is often expressed as not wanting to have children. Sometimes it's numbness, sometimes it's depression. We just notice in general people are exhausted, and the concern is that the people are increasingly isolated from often from their peers and from their friends as they work intensely on this topic. That there's often, as we discover as they talk about things in the workshops, that there's actually a lack of balance in their lives and little or no opportunity for the expression of the feelings that they carry, which of course leads to more isolation. And that's the intensity of the work, of course, is increasing because they know time's running out.
Thanks, Carol. So there's an experience of intense weight. They're shouldering a large responsibility. There's experiences of grief, sadness, anger, and despair. And often there's no outlet for that and a sense of isolation. We will circle back to the great work of Psychology for a Safe Climate and how you're supporting practitioners, scientists, and the other groups that you mentioned shortly. Before I do share a question with Alan, you've worked with populations who are particularly vulnerable to the mental health impacts of climate change. Can you tell us who these populations are and what factors are contributing to this vulnerability?
I can, but I'm in absolute awe about how people can be that concise. So excuse me if I ramble a little, but look, the main issues here about high priority populations, and I think we're using that preferably to talking about just vulnerable people because we're looking at a strengths rather than a deficit oriented language. So let's see if we can stick with that, although we know that there are risks as well as strengths that we should be considering. The people who are most likely to be affected first and worst with climate change events are going to be those with social determinants gaps. So people who live in abject poverty, so they have no choice about where they live, where you might have to live on a floodplain, where close to sea rise, fire grounds, excessive temperatures, poor quality food or scarce food and running out of water supply. If you live in unstable housing, if you are unemployed or a casual worker with a job that is fragile or like a concertina in terms of the shifts you get, if you have if you're in any community who is likely to be marginalized or alienated, like young people, elderly, disabled, including those with serious and persistent mental illness, and those who are traumatized, Indigenous and people who are in prison. So Indigenous and in prison too often go together. Asylum seekers and refugees. So, but if you are already living with a severe and complex mental illness, then and you have homelessness or crowded housing, and you find these extremes in both urban and in the most remote settings, then you may have what I've termed a quintuple whammy. And people have heard of about a double whammy, but this is a quintuple one. And I can count to five because I've had a quintuple bypass, so I know how to count to five. First part of that is having a severe and persistent mental illness. Secondly, if you have an alcohol and drug addiction disorder. Thirdly, if you have physical illness and disability, like a diabetes or a cardiovascular disorder, which can be worsened by some of the medications you might have to take. And if you have social determinant factors like the poverty, the unstable and uncoolable housing, the being unemployed, being overcrowded where you're living, and being incarcerated in psychiatric institutions. Some Aboriginal people, for instance, say that they were colonised twice, once by British invasion and secondly by the psychiatric or the prison system. You could be also the last of the five factors are being alienated, marginalised, stigmatised and politically neglected group by the wider society.
You promised a longer speech and I was a little bit surprised. Fabulous.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Look, so what you've set us up in understanding there is using a strengths approach when talking about priority populations, that the mental health outcomes of the impacts of climate change are mediated by the social determinants of health. The quintuple whammy, hopefully I've said that right, you've outlined colonisation and also the fifth point, I didn't quite capture because I was so engrossed, but what was it, Alan?
Being alienated or marginalised or stigmatised and politically neglected.
Thank you. Okay, Georgia. As a young person now working on planetary health, what has been your experience of climate change and mental health?
Thanks, Rebecca. And yeah, I'm honoured to have this opportunity today to share my perspective as a young person working in the climate health space. Just a disclaimer, we'll be referencing the impact of bushfires, so feel free to turn your volume off if you find this triggering. I guess my first memory of when climate change impacted my mental health was when I was roughly 12 years old. It was Saturday, the 7th of Feb, 2009, when the radio announced that change in wind direction and the head of that Black Saturday bushfire was heading straight for the town of Marysville, where my family's holiday cottage was situated. And although I probably didn't label it climate change at that time, I knew that my life, which some people may call a privileged one, and that is one with a roof over my head, access to education and a stable family income, I was susceptible to the changes happening to our planet and to our home. And I remember a few days later, as I saw the satellite images of the scarred town, I just felt feelings of shock and suddenly felt very small. So fast forwarding 9 years later to the Black Summer bushfire season in 2020, I don't consider myself to be affected by these fires as I wasn't physically there, but however, like many of us, I was absolutely devastated by the loss of bushland and innocent wildlife. So I guess my point is that it's no matter how old you are or where you live, how much money you have, or how far away we think we are to the problem, we're all indirectly and directly impacted by climate change in big and small ways. And as a young person with majority of their life hopefully still to be lived on this planet, I am concerned. I am concerned about the lack of action, the lack of conversation and urgency among all population groups, including my own, in dealing with something so detrimental to our lives. And my greatest fear is that I have no answer for when my future children ask me, well, why didn't you do or say something, Mum, when you knew it would affect me? That's my biggest fear, I think, and therefore my biggest motivation in working in this space. So my role now as Planetary Health Project Officer at Enliven, it's given me the opportunity to play my part and do my little bit in turning things around. And that makes me feel empowered and hopeful for the future. And I only wish for the same opportunities for other young people.
Thanks, Georgia. I think I possibly speak on behalf of the panel and other audience members in thanking you for sharing your response and sharing some of your journey and sharing your fears and concerns in a public forum. Very brave and courageous, and certainly very generous. And I know that you're doing some fantastic work in the field at Enliven, and we're looking forward to hearing more about some of the work that's happening with your great organisation. So thank you again. Okay, Tamara, our final respondent to this first kickoff question. You are a clinical psychologist and president of the APS. What you're seeing in your practice, what are the takeaways for psychologists and mental health workers more broadly?
So from my point of view, in terms of what I'm seeing, it's that climate change is coming up increasingly often. I think probably 5 years ago, it wouldn't have been a topic that I saw in my practice room. But I'm starting to see that there is people across the entire lifespan who are impacted by this in some way. And it's almost been advanced by the pandemic in the backdrop of that, because we've had for the first time widespread and worldwide uncertainty about the future. But also that concept that, you know, in the event that there is a large problem, it might not just be fixed overnight. And so I think that that has really brought into question a lot of people's thoughts on what mattered, and a lot of people's thoughts on it'll all just be okay. So for psychologists and what to take away, I think a huge one is that we need to get upskilled in cumulative trauma, because that is certainly something we are going to see in an ongoing basis. And certainly in Australia, that is one area where I just don't think we're going to get away from it. There's also really upskilling in areas of uncertainty and anxiety therapy skills. I think that that has huge elements to play in terms of what we offer and what our skill base is, because that is such a huge part of what we're seeing. And then I also think there's a huge advocacy role for psychologists. So very few people actually recognise that the science of psychology is actually pivotal in large-scale behaviour change and in public health messaging. So we often think just of the therapist in a room, but it is much broader than that when we're talking about wide-scale change.
What is cumulative trauma to support our audience in understanding?
Yeah, so cumulative trauma is those repeated major significant events in a person's life. And I think, you know, if we just did the last couple of years, we came out of drought into bushfires, out of bushfires into a worldwide pandemic, then into lockdowns, then hopefully out of lockdowns. So if you actually look at what those repeated massive and significant changes to a lot of people, it is literally cumulatively traumatic. So it's about, as psychologists and mental health workers, how we actually work with the fact that these are now starting to be ongoing traumas, and climate change is a huge part of that.
Thanks. That's a great explanation. So you're saying, Tamara, in the last 5 years, we've seen an uptick in people presenting around this issue, and that you're calling for upskilling around cumulative trauma, developing therapy skills, and also the really important role of advocacy as well for psychologists and mental health workers. Let's unpick it and tussle with it and dive a little bit deeper. But also bring forward some of the clinical and community examples. So it will be great to hear more from our panellists now about their experience in the clinical or community setting where the issue of climate change and mental health has arisen. Zabel, it's back to you to talk about the clinical practice experiences.
Sure. Thank you very much, Rebecca. When you look at all the research, is that both the health professionals, but also other adults that people go to with their climate distress are informed about climate and mental health. So great that people are here, and a really good step. So in terms of the clinical and community settings, I have one, which is that I work in telehealth and have been working since 2012 with rural and remote clinicians. And I've just been really struck by the number of experienced mental health clinicians who've spoken of the rises in serious self-harm and suicide attempts in younger children and also in adolescents, and that for many of these clinicians, this is a really striking difference from what it was like 20 years ago. And I think that's something that certainly stays with me and did lead me to be particularly wanting to understand the research better. The other one I wanted to touch on is a more recent one, which is really a mixture of kind of hope and also concern, which is a 9-year-old boy whose family gave me permission to present what is a very abbreviated version of his story. I saw again through telehealth with his parents and his local mental health clinician, who is a psychologist, just on the topic. And he presented actually with compound events. So the cumulative trauma is relevant. He was a boy who had been happily going to school, did have some other neurodevelopmental difficulties, but was functionally sleeping well, enjoying life, not really having any significant difficulties with the supports that he had. And then in the rural setting, the Black Summer fires came, 2019, 2020, and his dad went out to be a volunteer firefighter. And he, even though his dad came back safely, the experience of having the thick black smoke and the repeated experience of not knowing where his dad was extremely stressful. And after that, he had clear post-traumatic stress disorder and was unable to get to school or be separated from his parents. He then made some really good progress with excellent support from his parents, their community, and their local psychologist, and was doing well when the floods came. And one of his best friends, the best friend, it's okay, I'm trying to manage what trauma I'm exposing people to, but they were animals that were lost in the floods. The people were physically okay, but the level of distress that this caused for this boy was really very significant. And he again became unable to go to school, unable to separate from his parents, and actually was struggling with eating. Again, they bounced back, they got help, things got better. He was doing relatively well. And then the lockdowns related to COVID came. And while we could get into debates about the extent to which pandemics are more likely, certainly infectious diseases are more likely, regardless of that, the impact of those clearly increased events with climate change, so extreme bushfires and floods, meant that this boy was then much more vulnerable when another significant stressor occurred. And so he was actually lying, unable to do anything, in the fetal position on the floor of the room when he presented to the clinician. And this is a little boy who'd been happily going to school. Now, on the optimistic side, he and his community and his family have enormous strengths. And I actually think that he will benefit enormously and make great progress with the help that he'll get. But what he's been through and the vulnerability that leaves him and his family with is really significant and something that I think it's really important that we're here talking about tonight. So thank you. And I'm sorry I've gone a bit over time.
Thanks for sharing that. And to the parents who are too willing to pass that on as a clinical example. Over to Carol to talk about some of the clinical and community practice examples.
I just want to raise an example of burnout, which is an issue that we've come across in our work, where people who are particularly working on the climate crisis and contributing enormously to the action that's an activity that's needed to press for what's needed, but they are at risk of suffering burnout. If you think about somebody riding a bike without the tyres pumped up, how much effort goes into sort of keeping that bike moving without the air in the tyres? And that's an analogy for thinking about what it's like to keep on working in this space and contributing so much to something so important when there's actually there's no background reserves of energy. Another example is a way of thinking about is thinking about a car with the accelerator pressed as well as the brake, and that burns out the engine. And for people, it's about them pressing themselves, trying to accelerate, do more and more, while at the same time they're curious about slowing down that are being ignored. And look, this is a really serious problem. It takes a very long time to recover from. I've heard of people talking about of spending months in bed, or it's taking a whole year out of their lives just to sort of almost do nothing to just restore the capacity. So it's something that I think really needs to be thought about for those who are contributing so much. Please also listen to the cues of your colleagues and also care for themselves. The other aspect, if you think about it in a clinical sense, is to think about the stress that is caused in relationships around COVID, and that we can think about that sort of tension occurring around, you know, the tension about vaccination that can cause tensions in friendships, tensions in couple relationships, tensions in families, and similarly climate change can have that sort of tension impact on people in their lives. And so it's very similar and does need.
For commenting or drawing the picture of burnout that some of our colleagues are experiencing, and the cascading impact for their lives as they dedicate themselves to addressing climate change impacts. So thanks, Carol. We will circle back to you again soon to hear about some of the work that Psychology for a Safe Climate is doing to support workers. Alan, over to you to tell us a little bit more about perhaps the community setting.
The community I'd like to address is the small communities with Aboriginal majorities in the far west of New South Wales, which I've known well over the last 35 years, even while I was heading the service in Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, so which I did also for 30 years. So, and I'm so I've stayed involved with this with these communities, but the worrying thing is that, and again I've put this in a strength rather than a deficit frame, that so much was achieved by Aboriginal communities in the first 16 months of this pandemic, in terms of there being no deaths, hardly anyone in ICU. And now already with this Delta outbreak, there have been at least 3 deaths in Western New South Wales, and we don't know how many there are to come in the far west, with the consequences of having towns like Wilcannia being having the highest rate of COVID positive testing in a population anywhere in Australia. And there's a large but only recent effort that has gone into that town. So what actually happens in towns like this? Well, why they are in a sense their communities become sitting ducks for any climate related crisis, partly because, first of all, going on from what Tamara said about cumulative crises, they're also sometimes called compound crises and domino crises. And what we've had there is a sequence of prolonged drought. You saw this all the issues that arose around the Murray-Darling system, and the loss of water, the loss of fish, the loss of hunting because of the drought. These droughts were 10 years at a time, and then a short respite, and then it started again, and we had another 9 or 10 years. So then there was the drought, the extreme fires, the particulate matter ingesting and choking smoke and floods, that comes back to what Sibel was saying, and then now the pandemic. And it's, you know, it seems like biblical plagues complete with locusts and mice now. But this is the sort of pattern where you don't have time to recoil before you're knocked over again, is really very traumatizing and resensitizing to the trauma you've already had, as Fiona was saying. We also need to look at communities that are stigmatized and neglected, where governments have dropped the ball on vaccination, yet they're ready to open up and expose them to the virus, while the Aboriginal vax rates are so low in Australia wide. The Aboriginal longevity gap that we know about of 10 to 15 years has now been met and negatively synergized by the 20% vaccination gap. Anywhere in Australia, the Aboriginal rates of vaccination are about 20% lower than the common one in their state. Then there's overcrowding of households, nowhere to isolate, you know, and there's nowhere to isolate that was provided in some of these townships until after the virus had bolted. In other words, they were already living, trying to live in tents or trying to live in a crowded household in a corner. And it took them, it took a long while for governments that had neglected to fix housing or to provide more housing for many years and in many very short-term schemes that were never followed up. And running out of fresh water and fresh protein, there's hardly, and the food is very expensive and it's not fresh, loss of fishing and hunting, which did provide fresh protein, and there's little food security altogether. And then there's the positive of the attachment of land, no matter how much it may be, become degraded by heat or drought, and you have a loss of ways to draw on your strengths and collective identity if you don't stay attached to land in the collective community. So at the same time, these are also protective factors, and they operate for Indigenous people. And the strengths include collectivist communities. So they need to meet and see the wider kinship system and community. So they meet mainly at funerals, unfortunately, and more fortunately at football. But of course, if they run out of petrol money because they can't get a job, a pastoral job in the drought, that means they can't get to these major cultural events or cultural proxies. However, they talk about their resilience and teaching, they are able to teach the wider community how to make holistic, practical responses to climate change, because they've been through it before in very many ways. They've been through their so many crises of this kind that they feel we survived that, we're going to survive this. So there are strengths there that we could all learn from.
Georgia, responding to the community setting.
Yeah, sure. So at Enliven, we are quite active in the food system space. So we know that food insecurity or food shortages have a negative impact on all aspects of our health, and has risen throughout the pandemic and will continue to increase as our climate changes and population increases. At Enliven, we currently run a social marketing campaign called Food From Home, where we promote the climate and health co-benefits of edible gardening. And the campaign concept and key messaging was informed by a community insight survey. And the findings from this survey alluded to the main reasons why people grow food, and mental health was the top reason, with environmental reasons as a close second. So, I mean, this just adds the abundance of evidence that's already out there that links nature with mental well-being. And so food insecurity is a prevalent issue amongst our catchment area in Melbourne Southeast, with many families from a refugee and migrant background that have a low socioeconomic status as well. However, we found that when this population do have access to the space and resources to grow their own food, then this becomes a mental health promoting activity. Also, further to this, in the food system space, is the rapid urbanisation happening in Melbourne Southeast Growth Corridor, and it's putting quite a physical and mental strain on our farmers. So housing estates are being built quite close to neighbouring farmland, and this farmland is the home to, you know, one of Melbourne's major food bowls, located in the Cardinia Shire. And so farmers are losing their ability to farm the way they used to. So, for example, there's changes in rules in using machinery or lights late at night to avoid disruption to local residents. So, you know, this is putting a mental burden on top of the strain that climate change and the effect of drought or other extreme weather events are already having on our farmers.
Thanks, Georgia, and a nod there to the co-benefits of growing food to promote mental health and being part of a climate action, I would call growing your own food. Maybe is a little bit of fun that people might drop in the chat box what they're growing at the moment as a way to connect with that. Tamara, can you tell us about a clinical practice example?
Sure. So I'll sort of go across it broadly. So certainly the most concerning area at the moment is trauma related to extreme weather events. So I've had lots of people that have presented from being on the front line in the bushfires or family affected by them. including people who are struggling to leave their house because they're concerned that a fire might happen and they won't be there to protect themselves or their families. In terms of droughts, I've seen men who've spent their entire lives working on their family farm only to enter their retirement with no money in debt because the drought has taken much of what they had planned for their future. I've seen a broad array of people presenting with anxiety around climate change. So people considering whether or not they want to do parenthood as a result of what it might mean to bring a child into the world. Anxiety around how to talk to their children about what happened in terms of major weather events or climate change when questions come up. I've seen adolescents who are angry over what previous generations have done and how they will be the ones that will be impacted by the choices of someone else. And certainly all of those people who've been impacted by uncertainty, financial change, life changes and PTSD as a result of it. So for me, it's very broad ranging. And I think someone put in the chat box, it's not a typical assessment question, but it probably should be because it's increasingly going to be something that we see and have to manage.
Thanks, Tamara. And you're pointing us to the way forward there by prefacing that maybe assessment question is one instrument that we can add to our toolkit in developing our practice and, like you said before, upskilling. Fiona, a right of reply before we swap out to the solutions and the hope and coping type questions.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. So I've heard some really great comments that have really resonated with me from the other panelists, and particularly love Alan's description of how complex this system is operating. It's not just, there's so many factors at play here which are contributing to a community or a population's mental health. Always working in public health, I always sort of take the population or the community-wide view. And I just wanted to give an example very quickly. I know you don't want me to ramble, but we're doing some work out in Stanthorpe in Queensland. It's about 3 hours west of Brisbane for those people who are not from Queensland. Stanthorpe has been, it's a rural area. It's got quite a sizable town, but it is a predominantly an agricultural area, wine, fruit, and other sort of more traditional crops as well as livestock. It was one of the first places in Australia to be impacted by the 2019 bushfires. But prior to that, it's been in drought currently for about 10 years. I was speaking to just to backtrack a little bit. Then there were the bushfires. The bushfires moved south, and it was just covered in this blanket of smoke for months and months, which pretty much just finished any crops that were surviving. So it also, in that area nearby, has had floods. It's just been absolutely decimated, and that town is under enormous stress. But the stakeholders that we're talking to out there, that we're consulting with, we're talking to people who are farmers, we're talking to people who are from schools, we're talking to council and the whole spectrum, and what they are telling us is a very complex story of how people are being impacted by mental health. So every time one of these events comes through, it doesn't just cause trauma, which is clear to an individual, it degrades the social fabric of a community economically, politically, socially, on many, environmentally, obviously. Everything is kind of raised to the ground, and they have to rebuild. And they're just not getting time to rebuild like they used to. We would have a cyclone come through. I mean, our childhood was natural disasters, was cyclones up in North Queensland, or the occasional bushfire that made the news. It's not like that anymore. It's this cumulative trauma and cumulative events that people have identified. Communities don't know how to plan. Farmers don't know how to plan. The person I spoke to today said he used to work on a 3 to 4 year cycle, knowing that he would get bad years and good years within that. Now it's a 10-year cycle. So I just guess the takeaway message is that this is very complex. It's operating within a very complex system.
Thanks, Fiona. And I know that you're doing some system science, which is a community participatory research approach. And we really value and look forward to the stories that arise from the research that you're doing up there. Thank you. All right, let's get into the hope and coping space with a question to all of our panelists. So I'd like to ask each of our panel members to tell us about some of the resources, the supports, and approaches that are available to the audience on. Sibel, short, sharp overview of the solutions and resources.
Thank you very much. Something I'd like to comment on particularly first is the importance of self-care. And I know other speakers have covered this more than me, but it's just so important to look after your own well-being in order. Because you matter and because it's the right thing to do anyway, and because by doing that, you are then in a position to take effective action and to help others. So just that remembering about putting your own oxygen mask on first. And in terms of resources for that, some of the speakers here have already been talking about that. Psychology for a Safe Climate has some wonderful resources in terms of information and things that you can talk with, help you talk to your children about and things like that. The Australian Psychological Society has lots of resources. The Climate Resilience Network also has resources. And I'm imagining there are others, but if you Google any of them, you will get a bunch of readily available resources to help you and your community. In terms of working with patients in a clinical setting, for individual patients, the important things are that people who are experiencing distress about climate change need to have that distress validated and to meet with people who understand that being distressed about such a serious problem as climate change can be a rational and appropriate response, and that the way that you respond to that is based on validating, understanding, and encouraging the person to take the kind of action that's likely to help them manage that distress, such as things like connecting with nature. And it's important that people's normal and appropriate, well, not normal because it's not a normal situation, but rational and appropriate distress is understood in that context. Now, having said that, sometimes people will have such sustained distress or such lack of relief from it that they develop clinically significant mental health disorders. And sometimes it's happening in terms of extreme weather events or in terms of heat and the many other complex impacts. And then they need access to mental health professionals who can provide appropriate support. And again, great that people are here, because that's part of what's going to help that support be a good fit, is for people to be informed about mental health and climate change. And in terms of services, there are a whole lot of things to be doing. Some of that is discussed in that report that you'll be getting, but we do need to be planning for these increases in temperature, the associated increases in people having significant mental health distress, including suicidal behaviour, and actually also the consequences of interpersonal violence, which do increase with increasing hot weather and humidity. And the other part that I just want to mention, and then I will go, is just that actually speaking up as a community member or as a health professional is really important. And certainly as a health professional, part of your responsibility is to speak up where there's a serious threat to health. And I think that that's part of probably why some of us are here tonight. And one of the things that we know is that one of the sources of distress for people, particularly young people, is seeing that there's not proportionate sufficient action being taken by governments over a long period of time. So actually seeing leaders and seeing professionals stepping up and calling for that action is likely to be a step in the right direction of relieving some of that distress, as well as what we need to be calling for to reduce the harms going forward from climate change through legislation.
Sibel, you've a very compelling response to that question and gave us a really broad brush. Rational and appropriate response, I've double underlined here, and proportional, and a proportional response is required, which we don't quite have from the government at this point in time. Fiona, can you share some very quick examples of interventions to mitigate the mental health impacts of climate change?
Interventions. So I'm a public health researcher. So when I sort of look at community-based, population-based interventions. I think there's lots of people on the call today who can kind of talk to the more individual clinical type interventions. To be honest, there's not a lot that we know about community-based interventions to deal with the mental health impacts of climate change. There's lots been tried. There's lots of trying to adapt what we used to do in terms of like disaster recovery, for example. There's lots of people still trying to fit the old model to the new context. And that's just not going to cut it anymore. It's very, very clear that you can't just dump a bunch of resources into somewhere after a bushfire and rebuild it and then wait another 5 years before they're, or 10 years before they need any more help. That doesn't work anymore. So in terms of interventions, I don't have a lot of great advice to give because we just don't really know. There's a lot of people trying to do really good things, but I think we need to really look and evaluate and research what we really need to be doing.
Thanks, Fiona. I think there is some incredible work underway. It hasn't got to the level of the evidence base. I'm certainly aware of some of the work in Victoria. I can't speak to the rest of Australia, but the health promotion public health space is really getting activated, and there's various mandates now in place really guiding that work in the health promotion public health space. Alan, what approaches should we take to assist communities, most priority communities, to the mental health impacts of climate change?
Well, I think we need to set an optimal balance between public health and mental health prevention, early intervention, clinical mitigation and amelioration, and the wider things that both Fiona and others and I have been talking about. And that is, as clinicians, we should not stop there because of our toilet training in maintaining our narrow clinical gaze and focus and coming up with clinical diagnoses and solutions. It's just like having for he who has a hammer, everything is a nail. It's not like that. We need to widen our skills. So we also need local familiar service providers from your cultural mob who are therefore trusted and better able to communicate effectively and be role models. And that means not just having telehealth, but we need that balance between digitally augmented services, but having people who do people-to-people work and also face-to-face work, and also do assertive outreach to people in their home as needed. And also this is also a cultural thing, because in Aboriginal communities or in work that was done in British Columbia with First Nations people by Challenge and Lalonde, if you make sure that people from that cultural group also have roles within the fire department, the police department, not just health and schooling, but in all the community facilities and institutions, it actually helps for people to trust them, and there's a lower suicide rate. And that's before you get into climate change. But of course, when you're making a climate change response, it's even more important. And then we've got to sustain ongoing mental health services, including community outreach, as I was saying, but we need that telehealth connection. But we can't just do that management terms pivot thing completely to telehealth and think we don't need familiar local people on the ground. So then we need social movements and facilitating of community empowerment, and that, because that provides hope. And we need the proportionate responses that have been talked about. And we need extreme climate science denial and extreme vax opposition. We need that not to be thought about as just in terms of mental illness, like some people sort of tried to diagnose Mr. Trump, et cetera. And it's not just about mental illness and psychiatry, but it's about the psychology of cults led by demagogues and how to retrieve people from them humanely. And that, I think, connects with what Tamara was saying about the role of psychology in both communication and advocacy. So I think we need all those factors. And it is, as Fiona was saying, a community-wide and a wider community type of approach that needs to go wider. Our imperative should be to go wider all the time.
Thanks, Alan. You wove in Tamara's name there, so I'm going to pass to Tamara to tell us a little bit about the resources APS has developed in collaboration with others.
We have a series of focus resources for anyone in the public who has an interest in this. That includes things like talking with children about the environment, coping with climate change distress if you're experiencing it, dealing with burnout, and also some really great resources on what you can do and empowerment about climate change. So broader than just how to deal when it's emotional, but also what you can actively do to help in this space. And we have some very strong position statements, both short and long versions, so that you get all the detail if you need it. We are certainly keen to see real change in this area, and the science of psychology really bring what it can to the table around this.
Okay, Georgia, what do you see as being important in promoting mental health, particularly for young people?
Yeah, sure. I have three main things. Firstly, I think I come from a health promotion background, so all of these will be health promotion based, but I think using nature as a health promotion resource, solutions to ecological and youth mental health issues can be symbiotic, and so understanding the link between these is important for both preventing environmental degradation and then supporting youth mental health. And despite young people's concerns for the environment, their engagement with nature is relatively low, so supporting young people to develop the health literacy around the mental health benefits of connecting with nature is one way we could promote mental well-being. Secondly, fostering intersectoral collaboration. So effective policymaking in the climate health space requires a collaborative approach with decisions made across all sectors. So recognising that most public health challenges exist and could be improved outside of the health sector. And lastly, engaging young people in generating solutions. So eco-anxiety and climate grief are considered reasonable functional responses to climate-related losses, as it's been mentioned today, but they can be adaptive when channeled into productive and positive change. So strengthening and supporting young people's activism in the community may be an important approach to supporting their mental health and providing them with a sense of community and generating hope, whilst also maintaining pressure for action to mitigate climate change. I believe the knowledge, the lived experience and advocacy efforts of young people should not be seen as just a symbol of hope, but instead they should be included in the co-design process of policy and interventions and be respected as valuable contributors in generating long-term sustainable climate solutions, as well as it being an opportunity to support youth mental health at the same time.
Thanks, Georgia. Nature, collaboration and supporting to bring forward the voices of young people is absolutely critical. I appreciate that. Carol, I haven't forgotten you. Can you tell us about some of the work PSC, I think we can get down to abbreviations, is doing to support people working on climate change?
Thanks very much, Rebecca. We run workshops for people who are working as activists or scientists or researchers in the climate space, and we do that to address some of the issues I raised before about giving people a space to express the feelings that they carry and that they carry on behalf of all of us when they're working in this space day after day after day. And we really feel that the workshop gives a chance to be heard, to hear others, and to know that they're not alone, and that that they can then form connections with each other if they work from the same group working together, that they can have an ongoing connection with each other to talk about how they're feeling, to watch out for each other. We also include in those workshops some work on self-care and the importance of reflecting on the need to care for themselves and some giving some practices in care for themselves. And we find that people express the benefit of just stopping. As a group, especially who know each other from working together, or people who are drawn from diverse groups around the community, and that they feel the benefit of knowing that others feel as they do and that they have ongoing connections with others. And of course, we also remind people in those workshops and practice, having little breakouts to connect with nature and see how healing nature can be in just even a very short connection. We also run talks and interactive seminars. And for those mental health practitioners who are out there who may want to connect more deeply with this work so that they can respond to their clients or individuals, either individuals or groups that come to them, we're setting up a climate aware practitioners network and offering support to people to connect with the impact of climate change on themselves so that they're able to respond to those that come to them for care, whether it's as individuals or whether they're able to offer group support in their communities. So please have a look on our website for the Climate Aware Practitioners Network to hear about our professional development opportunities.
So that was the Climate and Health Alliance expert panel discussion on climate change and mental health. Please look at the show notes where I'll include the report. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next week.
That was a repeat episode of the Climate Action Show, and we'll be back next week.